Initial reports told of rooms reeking with filth, of walls, floors, and pillars caked with offal, dried blood, and flesh, of unspeakable uncleanliness. These findings were more than sufficient to convince Roosevelt to take action. On May 22, Illinois Senator Albert Beveridge introduced a White House-backed bill to institute a rigid federal inspection program covering all phases of the packing industry, from animal slaughter to sausage and canned meat production. If products were found healthful and fit for human food, a government label indicating inspected and passed would be attached. If not, the meat products would be marked inspected and condemned. Roosevelt warned Senate leaders friendly to the packers that unless effective meat inspection legislation were enacted without loss of time, he would make the report public. Although he had no desire to harm the packing industry or the livestock producers, if the meat packers moved to kill the legislation, he would feel compelled to expose the sickening work conditions. Fearing adverse publicity even more than the regulation, the packers retreated. Without a dissenting vote, the Beveridge bill passed the Senate 3 days after it was introduced. While Roosevelt was satisfied, Upton Sinclair remained disappointed by the bill's quick passage. Release of the report, he told the president, would give the public a shock it will never get over, prompting true, enduring reform through an enlightened public opinion. Disregarding Roosevelt's directive to remain patient while the House took up the Senate bill, Sinclair leaked his information from the report to the New York Times. "I sincerely hope that the disturbance I have been making has not been an annoyance to you," he told Roosevelt. "I had to make up my mind quickly." Exasperated, Roosevelt wrote to Frank Doubleday, "Tell Sinclair to go home and let me run the country for a while." The legislation, meanwhile, foundered in the House Agricultural Committee, chaired by wealthy stockbreeder James Wadsworth, a strong proponent of the Beef Trust. One after another, witnesses were paraded before the committee to argue that while isolated problems might exist, conditions were as clean and wholesome as in the average restaurant, hotel, and home kitchen. That there were offensive odors was natural. One ought not to expect to find a rosebud in a slaughtering house. A series of emasculating amendments was prepared, one negating the mandatory character of inspection and granting packers the right of court review. "I am sorry to have to say," Roosevelt informed Congressman Wadsworth, "that it seems to me that each change is for the worse, and that in the aggregate they are ruinous, taking away every particle of good from the suggested Beveridge Amendment." Because the packers and their representatives had reneged, producing only sham legislation, the president felt he was not warranted any longer in holding back the unfinished Neil Reynolds report. On June 4th, the president transmitted what he called a preliminary report to Congress. "The conditions shown by even this short inspection," he avowed, "were revolting." His investigators had determined that the stockyards and packing houses are not kept even reasonably clean, and that the method of handling and preparing food products is uncleanly and dangerous to health. Federal legislation was imperative to prevent continued abuses. If Congress failed in its responsibility, the full report would be made public. Released to the newspapers, this preliminary assessment produced a national uproar. The New York Post captured the public mood in a sardonic jingle. "Mary had a little lamb, and when she saw it sicken, she shipped it off to packing town, and now it's labeled chicken." Faced with public outrage and disgust, the House could no longer keep the bill chloroformed in the committees. The most egregious of Wadsworth's provisions were eliminated, and the measure was sent to a conference committee. In the end, a fairly comprehensive meat inspection bill emerged. "We cannot imagine any other president whom the country has ever had paying any attention at all to what was written in a novel," the New York Evening Post remarked. "In the history of reforms which have been enacted into law," Beveridge proudly noted, "there has never been a battle which has been won so quickly, and never a proposed reform so successful in the first contest." The momentum of the railroad regulation fight and the meat inspection amendment propelled the passage of a third important bill, the Pure Food and Drug Act, producing an historic session of congressional reform. Crusaders, like Dr. Harvey Wiley, chief chemist in the Department of Agriculture, had battled unsuccessfully for over a decade to secure federal legislation requiring proper labels on food and drugs. In the absence of such regulation, adulterated food products and bogus medicines flooded the market. Conservatives lampooned Wiley as chief janitor and policeman of the people's insides. In the Senate, Nelson Aldrich emerged as the most vocal opponent of regulatory measures. "Are we going to take up the question as to what a man shall eat and what a man shall drink," he scornfully asked, "and put him under severe penalties if he is eating or drinking something different from what the chemists of the agricultural department think it is desirable for him to eat or drink?" Pressure for reform began to build, however, with the publication of two groundbreaking articles in Collier's magazine. Interested in commissioning an investigative piece on the patent medicine industry, the Ladies' Home Journal editor Edward Bach reached out to S.S. McClure to find a writer capable of painstaking research. McClure introduced Bach to Mark Sullivan, a recent graduate of the Harvard Law. Sullivan's article proved too technical and too extensive for the Ladies' Home Journal, but Bach brought it to Collier's, where it attracted widespread attention. Sullivan's research yielded some stunning discoveries. The Lydia E. Pinkham Company, a celebrated patent medicine firm, advertised its numerous compounds for ailing women beneath the kindly and intelligent visage of Mrs. Pinkham, offering the promise that she would personally answer letters and dispense advice to inquiring customers. When Sullivan traveled to her hometown of Lynn, Massachusetts, and learned that she had been dead for over two decades, he took a picture of the inscription on her headstone. Lydia E. Pinkham died May 17, 1883. Less grimly humorous, but far more pernicious, were the young journalist's revelation that a secret clause had been written into the advertising contracts of thousands of newspapers across the country. At that time, patent medicines provided the largest source of advertising revenue for newspapers, and this clause stipulated that the contract would be canceled if material detrimental to the industry appeared anywhere in the paper. From William White, who had refused to take patent medicine ads in the Emporia Gazette, Sullivan obtained an original copy of the contract form. The success of Sullivan's piece prompted Collier's to commission a 10-part investigative series on the patent medicine industry, modeled after McClure's exposés. In fact, the writer of the series, Samuel Hopkins Adams, had been on McClure's staff before moving to Collier's. Adams procured experts to test more than 200 patent medicines, a great majority of which were revealed as either harmless frauds or deleterious drugs. An ointment containing clay and glycerin was marketed as a cancer cure. A pink starch and sugar pill promised to remedy paralysis. Isham's spring water claimed rheumatism would vanish within days. Even more worrisome, many concoctions were found to contain significant quantities of alcohol and narcotics, potentially leading the unwary toward addiction. Laboratories claiming to test these medicines turned out to be fraudulent or non-existent. For the first time, public pressure impelled a bill regulating food and drugs to run the gauntlet of the upper house in safety. After reaching the house, however, it slept. And it slept. For 4 months, Speaker Joe Cannon refused to bring the legislation to the floor for a vote. Finally, the national uproar over diseased meat forced his hand. On June 30, 1906, reformers were finally able to celebrate the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. The bill would not have had the slightest chance of surviving in the House, Senator Beveridge observed, had it not been for the agitation generated by the Meat Inspection Amendment. This landmark bill authorized the federal government to examine the contents of processed food and patent medicines, to forbid the sale of adulterated or misbranded food and drugs, and required that every package and bottle be properly labeled. "During no session of Congress since the foundation of the government," the New York Times proclaimed, "has there been so much done, first, to extend the federal power of regulation and control over the business of the country, and second, to cure and prevent abuses of corporation privileges." Had Congress accomplished even one of the three major steps toward railroad regulation, meat inspection, or food and drug oversight, one Midwestern paper observed, the first session of the 59th Congress would have been historic. Taken together, these three monumental measures marked the beginning of a new epoch in federal legislation. Governmental regulations on corporations and the invocation of the police power, so to speak, to stay the hand of private greed and protect the general welfare. No sooner had journalists illuminated a problem than the fight to secure a remedy had begun. By the spring of 1906, it was virtually certain that Congress would pass measures to regulate the railroads and the food and drug industry. Only the timing and nature of those regulations remained to be determined. For pass them they must, McClure's biographer noted. That verdict had already been reached by the people. The momentum of the progressive agenda continued with an employer's liability law for the District of Columbia, the Antiquities Act that granted the president authority to declare national monuments on federal lands, and statehood bills for Arizona and New Mexico. While conservatives railed against the most amazing program of centralization ever enacted, and Wall Street warned that Roosevelt was only sowing the seeds of revolution, the American people overwhelmingly agreed with the president's declaration that this Congress had accomplished more substantive work for good than any Congress has done at any session since he became familiar with public affairs. Even Democratic newspapers reluctantly acknowledged the unprecedented efficacy of the 59th Congress and the remarkable leadership of the president. "The public confidence has been greatly restored in our lawmakers," observed the Detroit Free Press, "inasmuch as strongly reformative measures have been adopted in the face of tremendous private interests, the sole spur necessary being an insistent public demand clearly defined." Yet even as he gloried in the moment, Theodore Roosevelt sensed that he would never again achieve this magnitude of success in directing domestic policy. "I do not expect to accomplish very much in the way of legislation after this Congress, and perhaps after this session," he wistfully confided to his son, Kermit. "By next winter, people will begin to think more about the next man who is to be president. And then, too, by that time, it is almost inevitable that the revulsion of feeling against me should have come. It is bound to come sometime, and it is extraordinary that it has not come yet." Chapter 18. Cast into Outer Darkness. To McClure's matchless team of journalists, the legislative record of the 59th Congress represented not a fait accompli, but the first successful skirmishes in a much larger war on the corrupt consolidation of wealth and power. "Signs everywhere now show a great moral awakening," Baker told his father. "The cleaning out of rotten business and still more rotten politics. But we've only begun." For the first time, Baker explained, men were questioning the fundamentals of democracy, inquiring whether we truly had self-government in America, or whether it had been corrupted by selfish interests. "Most importantly," Baker continued, "this questioning came not alone from what one might call the working class, but from middle America as well." Investigative journalism, one historian observed, had assumed the proportions of a movement, exerting an influence on the American consciousness hardly less important than that of Theodore Roosevelt himself. Magazines like McClure's had become so politically significant that William Allen White quipped, "It was as if we had government by magazine." During these heady days, Finley Peter Dunn's Irish bartender Mr. Dooley waxed poetic on the power of the printed word, noting that it had the strength to make a star to shine on the lowliest brow, or to blacken the fairest name in Christendom. A mere 3 years before, Dooley explained, John D. Rockefeller had enjoyed the reputation of undiluted success and civic rectitude, until, lo and behold, up in his path leaps a lady with a pen in hand, and off goes John D. for the tall timbers. More astonishingly, Dooley marveled, the same few years had seen a work of fiction rout the beef trust, and Ray Baker's lead pencil produce a revolution in Congress. And when a state wanted to elect a governor or a city a mayor, they turned not to professional politicians, but to Lincoln Steffens, Yes, decried Mr. Dooley. The hand that rocks the fountain pen is the hand that rules the world. To outsiders, the solidarity of McClure's enterprise appeared impregnable. In 1906, Sam McClure was considered among the 10 most important men in America. His gifted writers operated more like an intimate team, an extended family, than the staff of a magazine. For Ida Tarbell, now in her 12th year at McClure's, the magazine provided freedom, security, and comradeship. Here was a group of people I could work with, without sacrifice or irritation, Tarbell later reflected in her autobiography. Here was a healthy, growing undertaking which excited me, while it seemed to offer endless opportunity to contribute to the better thinking of the country. Ray Baker felt similarly, recognizing the rare group McClure had assembled, all genuinely absorbed in life, genuinely in earnest in their attitude toward it, and yet with humor, and yet with sympathy, and yet with tolerance. The magazine was a success, Steffens recalled. We had circulation, revenue, power. In the building up of that triumph, we had been happy, all of us. It was fun, the struggle. In the spring of 1906, however, just when the future looked fair and permanent, Ida reminisced, the apparently solid creation was shattered, and I found myself sitting on its ruins. Ray Baker's memoir registered similar grief and disbelief. The institution that had seemed to me as permanent as anything could be in a transitory world, I mean McClure's magazine, seemed to be crumbling under my feet. The schism that ended McClure's glorious era shocked the publishing world and devastated the staff. While the McClure team had long been accustomed to the rapid mood swings that drove Sam McClure into alternating periods of manic energy and pathological torpor, his creative wizardry had always compensated for his mercurial behavior. Never forget, Ida Tarbell had counseled every time McClure riled the office with one of his outbursts, that it was he and nobody else who built the magazine, that all the great schemes, the daring moves, the ideas that had propelled his writer series and finally the writers themselves into national acclaim originated with him. But in recent months, the frenetic shifts from one grandiose plan to another had become more frequent, the melancholy periods infinitely darker. These radical vacillations in temperament compelled months of bed rest and even destroyed McClure's interest in the work he had always adored. While still capable of brilliance, McClure exhibited increasingly erratic behavior that took a cumulative toll on his colleagues. One of Sam McClure's escapades in the summer of 1903 had marked the first in a series of troubling events that became distressingly emblematic of the way his compulsions began to compromise the accomplishments and aspirations of his friends and colleagues at the magazine. McClure had invited Ida to join him and Hattie at Divonne-les-Bains, the popular spa town in eastern France on the border of Switzerland. Worried that her grinding work on the Standard Oil project was impacting her health, McClure hoped that she would join them for the entire summer season. "You are infinitely precious to me," he told Ida. "I dreamed about you last night," he revealed to her, "and awoke this morning very anxious about you." If she found the pace of the series pressing her, he would gladly rein it in. "The truth is, you have taken the forward place in my heart of all my friends," he wrote. "I want to live near you and be much with you during the coming years." The prospect of a European vacation with Sam delighted Ida, but her work kept her in New York until July. In her absence, McClure invited a young poet, Florence Wilkinson, and a newlywed couple, Alice and Cale Rice, to accompany him to London and France. Wilkinson, a tall, dark-haired beauty, conducted poetry classes at her Greenwich Village studio. Four of her poems, at Sam's direction, had recently appeared in McClure's. The inclusion of Wilkinson's slight romantic verse in a magazine that had published the poetry of William Butler Yeats and A.E. Housman befogged the staff, who suspected their editor's fascination with the girl betrayed his usually impeccable judgment. The Cales would become well-known writers, but at the time Alice Hegan Rice had published her first novel, and her husband had produced two slim volumes of poetry. In London, McClure had arranged luxurious accommodations and memorable entertainment for his young friends, including a dinner at the Vagabondia with a circle of illustrious writers, and an evening of theater in the box of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. After arranging British publishers for the three aspiring writers, McClure brought them to Devon. A week later, while Hattie stayed behind seeking relief for her rheumatism, the ever-restless McClure set out with Wilkinson and the Cales for Chamonix and Mont Blanc. At the Hôtel de Paris, he arranged rooms for the Rices on the second floor, while he and Florence Wilkinson stayed on the third. By the time Florence left the group for Bellagio, the intimacy that had developed between McClure and the young poet was apparent to the Rices. When Ida Tarbell joined McClure and the Rices in the Swiss village of Gleisch, the newly organized traveling party set forth on a walking tour of the Alps. In the course of 3 weeks, they trekked from the valley of the Rhone to Lucerne in Zurich, and then onto the Engadine Valley in Italy, stopping at small inns along the way. Their rollicking adventure, Alice Rice recalled, was conducted by McClure, their buccaneer leader, who went through life like a tornado, carrying everything in its wake. Reaching St. Moritz in the late afternoon as fashionable carriages paraded along the thoroughfare, McClure was so exhilarated by the beauty of the mountain scene that he lost his head completely, challenging Cale to scale a hill and then somersault down its slope. So, Alice remembered, to the utter amazement of the summer residents taking their afternoon drive, two wild Americans came catapulting down the hillside, landing in the promenade almost under their horses' feet. During that never-to-be-forgotten European tour, Alice Rice and her husband forged a lifelong friendship with Ida Tarbell. Toward the end of their journey, the young couple, in all likelihood, confided the intimacy they had witnessed between Florence and Sam. Tensions grew until Ida could barely contain her tears when they parted, and McClure rightly feared that he had diminished himself in her eyes. "I have felt terribly sad since you left," he lamented in a subsequent letter. "I have no friend like you, and I cannot endure to have hurt you and forfeited any of your confidence," he explained, begging her forgiveness, promising never to take another party to the Alps of any kind, just my family and you and other of my associates. Ida's real distress was not driven by prudish disdain for his amorous entanglements. Instead, she feared that Sam McClure's recklessness could tarnish the magazine with hypocrisy. In article after article, McClure's had exposed immoral businessmen and politicians. The authority of their painstaking investigations rested on the integrity of the writers and editors. Clearly, public scandal involving the magazine's charismatic founder would be a valuable weapon for those seeking to demean all their efforts. After returning to New York that fall, Ida shared her apprehensions with John Phillips. When Sam departed alone for a 2-month European stay that November, they feared he planned to meet with Florence. His letters home revealed a mood of exultation. "I feel sure of myself as I haven't for many years. I am stronger on this trip than I was any time in 10 years, he wrote from Berlin. Sam's buoyant tone persisted as he traveled through Germany and back to London. "I am so much keener and sharper than ever," he boasted. "I feel my vision broadened and feel strong physically and mentally." When McClure suddenly embarked on a solo holiday in the Appalachian Mountains in the spring, Tarbell and Phillips were convinced the sojourn was engineered to meet his lover. In May, the office erupted into turmoil when McClure directed the poetry editor, Witter Binner, to purchase yet another of Florence's verses, this time a lover's poem that seemed directed to McClure himself. McClure composed a letter announcing the poem's imminent publication in the magazine. He then asked Binner to present the announcement to Miss Wilkinson personally, accompanied by a lavish arrangement of fresh flowers. When Tarbell and Phillips learned of these instructions, they upbraided Sam like a naughty child. By this time, Hattie had learned about the affair, and turbulent days followed. A chastened McClure swore he would finally end the relationship, and apparently informed Florence that they must sever all communication. A week later, Sam departed for Europe with his wife. Upon reaching Devon, Hattie wrote Ida that something very terrible had come up during the ocean voyage. Sam had confessed to the existence of numerous letters written to Florence over the previous year. Immediately realizing all the possibilities implied in that circumstance, Hattie urged her husband to have John Phillips retrieve his correspondence, but Sam was wild at that idea. Instead, he penned another letter to Florence requesting the return of all his letters. As the time approached when an answer could be expected, Hattie confided in Ida, Sam fell into a terrible condition. He lost flesh, nearly a pound a day for nearly a week. Every day, he fretfully awaited the postman. "I have so much to do right for," the overwrought McClure confessed to Tarbell during this interval. "I couldn't bear to lose you," he continued, "not to speak of John or the others. I am now at the bottom. I can go no further, nor feel any sadder. I am about to take the desperate but sure cure. 3 weeks, in bed and milk." Realizing that their friend was ill-equipped to resolve the situation, Tarbell and Phillips decided they must intervene. Knowledge of extant letters exchanged between the illicit lovers confirmed their worst fears. "The Lord help us," Ida exclaimed. Concluding that they must approach Florence Wilkinson directly, Tarbell considered visiting the Finger Lakes where Florence was spending the summer. There, Tarbell would make an appeal for courage, hopeful that the young woman would return the letters and refuse further contact with Sam. "I fear I would be hard on her," Ida admitted to John as they considered their options, "but I will honestly try to put that out of my mind and help the girl if she will let me." In the end, Ida decided it might be wiser for Phillips to make the appeal, since it was quite natural that Florence should feel resentment towards her. The shy Phillips agreed to undertake the unpleasant task, meeting with Wilkinson in upstate New York, where he secured her promise to return the letters and refrain from further communication with McClure. Although Florence initially kept her part of the bargain, Sam could not keep his. "I have received 6 or 7 letters and 2 cable messages," Florence informed Phillips. "The letters," she told him, "I have returned mostly sealed as they came. It hurts me more than words can say." While she had indeed sent a packet containing all McClure's correspondence, Florence could not bear to reject unopened all his new letters. "I think his health is suffering unnecessarily under the strain of absolute silence," she wrote. "I think, too, he is in an agony of doubt as to my feelings toward him. I wish he could know that I love him as well as ever, though I am never to see him." Despite Philip's concerns, she desperately wished to post one letter assuring Sam that love by itself is not wrong. Phillips should understand that it was not humanly possible for his side to snap off so suddenly, though she would do her utmost to ease the situation. McClure's longtime friend and London office manager, Mary Bisland, reported to Ida that Sam could not stop talking about Florence, protesting that he had been wretched and restless since the separation, and insisted that he had not the very vaguest idea of giving her up, though he feared she was now determined to end the affair. At times, McClure seemed to listen to reason, making very solemn promises to Hattie that he would devote himself to her, and that she would once again work in the office by his side. But such pledges alternated with dark declarations that he would leave New York for a year or more, perhaps never to return. "He said he was a hurt animal who wanted to crawl into a hole and hide forever," Hattie sadly told Ida. "My heart is broken to see how weak he is. He must learn over again to live with me and do right." Yet, even during his most depressed days in Europe, McClure never failed to follow every detail of the magazine's progress, continuing to provide valuable input. Writing to Tarbell in June of 1904, he captured the vision articulated in recent articles. "The struggle for possession of absolute power, which you find in your work among capitalists, and Steffens finds among politicians, and Baker finds among labor unions, is the age-long struggle, and human freedom has been won only by continual and tremendous effort." Much as he admired Steffens' articles on corruption, he warned Phillips that they were full of dynamite, far and away the most terrible stuff we can handle. "Steffens must never be rushed. he further cautioned, and his use of invective must be carefully curtailed. In the article on Wisconsin, for example, Steffens had accused Senator Spooner of bribing state legislators to obtain his Senate seat. "Unless Spooner was elected by bribery, we must clear him," McClure instructed. "Either he or the magazine must be cleared." The article on Aldrich would be equally sensational, and must be very understated and very accurate. Compounding his unease, McClure intuited that the atmosphere at the magazine had become less collegial. He feared that, with each writer working in his own little cubicle in his own little field, each would fail to get the inspiration or the information that would vitalize his work from other departments. While his perceptions were by and large astute, Sam McClure also fired off a series of ill-tempered critiques that upset staffers in New York. They bristled at his particularly high-handed indictment of an internal advertisement extolling the magazine's growing reputation. "The man who is responsible for this advert is relieved from further ad writing absolutely," McClure haughtily ordered, complaining, "Why in the name of ordinary decency and modesty do we have to vaunt ourselves like this, saying we are the best? We act like a spoiled, over-petted, and overpraised but ill-bred small boy." He implored Hattie to write a separate letter conveying to everyone in the office the depth of his displeasure. Henceforth, he demanded, not a single ad should be run without his express approval. Put to bed under doctor's orders to begin the dreaded milk cure yet again, Hattie reported he had asked her to read some of the magazine's recent short stories, which, she had concluded, were very poor, trashy, empty things, far below the old McClure standard. Future stories, he then insisted, should be sent to Devone so Hattie could determine if they seemed unworthy. Phillips patiently answered Sam's diatribes, but he began to wonder if his oldest friend would ever be healthy enough to return to full-time work. Hattie's determination to forgive her husband's past indiscretions was severely tested when she received a shattering letter from Miss Wilkinson. Florence had learned that she was not the only other woman in Sam's life. Her dearest friend, Edith Weary, had revealed her own romantic relationship with McClure, which had apparently developed after the fateful European vacation. Florence had written Hattie in a fit of jealous anger, intending to injure Sam in his wife's eyes. The distressing missive spurred Sam into belated recognition that he would have to take control of the quickly deteriorating situation. "Yesterday," he wrote to Phillips, "Mrs. McClure received a letter from Florence that brought about a condition that resulted in my making a complete fini to the terrible affair, and I have so written to Miss W. You have done nobly, and Miss Tarbell, but now the matter is finished absolutely. There is no possible chance for further troubles." McClure managed to convince his wife that Miss Wary's confession was a mere figment of the young girl's imagination, and the troubled couple headed home with a commitment to resume their marriage. While Hattie admitted that her heart was still wrung with the anguish of it all, she told Sam that she was willing to leave everything in the past, now that he had ended his strange wanderings. Returning home, Sam professed his resolve to abandon all distraction and philandering, insisting to Ida Tarbell that her devoted efforts had saved him. He was so horrified by the awful course of the past year or two that he dared not dwell on it, fearing he would never again be first in her esteem and affections. If he were unable to regain her confidence, he wrote to Ida, that alone would serve as lasting punishment for all he had done. Despite his contrition, there remained a disagreeable postscript to the Wary episode. When Sam was in Chicago months later, Edith Wary sent a manuscript to Hattie with the alarming title of The Shame of S.S. McClure, illustrated by letters and original documents. Miss Wary claimed that she was determined to live henceforth in truth and honor. Accordingly, the wall of lies which had sheltered her liaison with Sam must be raised. Hattie brought the explosive manuscript to the office, seeking the counsel of Tarbell and Phillips. An urgent telegram was dispatched, urging McClure's immediate return to New York. When he arrived the next day, the staff drew up a financial compensation plan to suppress the manuscript. McClure's return to the magazine seemed to revive him. Bursting with new concepts, he proposed that Steffens embark on an investigation of life insurance companies and that Tarbell take on the United States Senate, predicting that the whole future of the country would be determined by that most powerful ruling body. During a trip through the Midwest that summer, he stopped in Emporia to visit William Allen White and reported that he was getting along splendidly in both his work and learning, and that he was poised to do greater editing than ever before. Relieved to witness the lift in McClure's spirits, Phillips and Tarbell nevertheless mistrusted his leadership after the enervating months of crisis. Not only did Tarbell ignore his suggestion to study the Senate, she had also, McClure sorrowfully noted, neglected to write to him during his travels. "I thought when I came back," he told her, "I could stand the years of waiting until I earned your confidence and regained my place with you and Mr. Phillips." Now, McClure feared that things would never be the same, and that realization placed a heavy load on his heart. "My mind constantly dwells in the past, and more especially the first 4 years of the magazine," he plaintively confided to Ida. "They were the golden years of my life. I often dream of being back with you all. I feel also how much I have done to destroy the most precious possession of my life." Impelled by a feverish desire to reclaim the affection and respect of his colleagues, McClure spent days and nights developing an elaborate plan for a new monthly companion magazine to McClure's. Transported by manic excitement, McClure convinced himself that it would be the greatest periodical ever published in America. Once his staff understood the brilliance of the scheme, McClure exulted, they would acknowledge that he was a stronger and more productive man than ever. In late November of 1905, he sent the finished prospectus to Tarbell. He was sharing a tremendous secret, he wrote, which he hoped would mollify any anxieties she might continue to harbor. McClure's Universal Journal, the second monthly he envisioned, would be larger than the current magazine, attracting the most famous novelists and short story writers in the world, and featuring serious articles about current issues. Single copies would cost but 5 cents, one-third the price of McClure's magazine. The lower price would be accomplished by utilizing less expensive paper and relying on pen and ink illustrations instead of costly copperplate engravings. McClure predicted a net yearly income of $2 million and proposed to found the company by issuing nearly $13 million in stock. The staff of McClure's would manage both the current magazine and the new journal. But Sam McClure's extravagant ambitions were not confined to the publishing world alone. The new monthly would be affiliated with 4 interlocking, profitable enterprises that would help solve pressing social problems: a people's bank, a people's life insurance company, a people's university to issue textbooks on all subjects and develop correspondence courses, and a universal library to supply the public with affordable copies of great works of literature no longer covered by copyright. In addition to these boggling schemes, McClure planned to purchase 1,000 acres of land upon which to build a model community with affordable housing. Far from being intrigued, Tarbell considered McClure's grandiosity as a manifestation of his illness, as a manic projection that eclipsed the gratification of real accomplishment. His compulsion to build a bigger, a more imposing house of McClure would only jeopardize the magazine to which she had devoted her best years. McClure's Universal Journal would inevitably compete for the same readers as McClure's magazine, diminishing the value of her stock in the magazine and destabilizing the entire enterprise. Most troubling of all, whether the product of megalomania or the most beneficent of motives, McClure's scheme of consolidating different enterprises under the same roof echoed the very trusts against which she and her colleagues had waged war. Her instincts told her that this was the plan which was eventually to wreck his enterprises. When John Phillips saw McClure's prospectus, he understood more clearly than Tarbell that the company's finances would never support a venture of this magnitude. As the largest minority stockholder and managing editor during Sam's repeated absences, Phillips had all the different branches of the work in his hand. The advertising department, the editorial section, the book publishing arm, the printing press, the art department. Over the years, Sam's traveling expenses had been a continuing drain on the treasury. In his expansive moods, the publisher would impulsively purchase twice as many articles as the magazine could possibly use. He had signed deals to extend the company's operations that ultimately had to be abandoned at heavy cost. He had rewarded his writers and artists with money and generous gifts. Though the magazine itself continued to flourish, the company was under stress. For the previous 5 years, the steadfast Phillips had anchored the magazine. While Sam wandered through Europe, the quiet editor remained at his desk from early morning until late at night, managing the business details and working intimately with each of the writers. Ray Baker later said that he had never known an editor who had so much of the creative touch, a kind of understanding which surprised the writer himself with unexpected possibilities in his own subjects. An uncompromising critic, Phillips told his writers exactly why their articles did not work, often recommending remedies and suggesting felicities of expression which the author would have liked to think of first. William Allen White declared that without Phillips, the staff would not know where to go or what to do. The dynamic between Phillips and McClure had been established for a quarter of a century. When McClure was editor-in-chief of the college newspaper, John kept the paper running while Sam disappeared for days at a time. In Boston, Phillips edited the bicycling magazine The Wheelman, while Sam traveled around New England in search of writers and ideas. In the early days of their New York syndicate, Phillips managed the operations while McClure crossed the ocean to meet with Kipling, James Barrie, and Conan Doyle. When they were young, John had so admired Sam's energy, his push and business ability, that he would readily have changed places with him. As Sam's mood swings intensified over the years, Phillips willingly assumed more and more of his partner's responsibilities. Finally, however, Phillips' vaunted patience snapped. The combined impact of the Wilkinson affair, the vituperative letters from Devon, and Sam's preemptive hiring of a high-salaried art director for the new venture proved too much. After McClure's rash hiring decision, Tarbell and Phillips quickly resolved to work in tandem and persuade McClure to abandon his scheme. During the Wilkinson crisis, the two had formed a close bond. Faced with this new catastrophe, they spent many hours together strategizing over lunches in the city and dinners in each other's homes. The affection and trust Tarbell had once reserved for McClure was now claimed by Phillips. "He is certainly the rarest and most beautiful soul on earth," she told Albert Boyden, McClure's managing editor. In mid-January, craving respite from the office maelstrom, Tarbell joined John and Jenny Phillips on a trip to Kansas, Colorado, and the Grand Canyon. In Emporia, they stayed with William Allen White, who accompanied them for the remainder of the voyage. "It has been a glorious trip," Tarbell cheerfully wrote Boyden. Their buoyant mood was soon spoiled when they received a series of letters forwarded from the office indicating that the General had defied their objections and moved ahead in their absence to incorporate the McClure's Journal Company. "Phillips, as usual, is an angel and has written McClure a beautiful letter," Tarbell reported to Boyden. "But conditions in the office had reached a diabolical stage, requiring a unified action to stop the madness." McClure informed Phillips that his letter had come the very morning that the new Journal's art director had arrived at the office. "The distraction thoroughly unfitted me for the work with him," Sam peevishly objected. "I'm engaging upon a tremendous task, a noble and splendid one. I have the greatest idea for a periodical ever invented, and am entering upon an enterprise that will benefit everyone also tremendously. And nothing but a large recovery of my original calmness of mind, and what at one time was unruffable good nature, will enable me to stand what are really petty and useless annoyances and opposition. As one of the most successful business organizers in this country," he continued, "it never occurred to me that having founded one business, I could not found another." McClure went on to assert that his mind was settled. He would not only launch McClure's Journal, but would create a weekly magazine in the near future. Phillips, McClure suggested, had a tendency to look upon the dark side of things. He recommended that his oldest friend take a 2-year paid vacation to gain perspective on his ridiculous concerns. Additional letters from anxious staff members soon reached the vacationers, pleading with them to return before the Enterprise suffered irreparable damage. "All SS wants is sympathy and a recognition of his genius," Dan McKinley wrote. Their editor, he continued, feels he is not master in his own shop. He feels that his opinions and ideas are no longer considered worthy of serious thought. Albert Boyden acknowledged that those who remained in the office could no longer cope with the situation. "I wish we did have the brains and wisdom and patience to work it out without you," he wistfully wrote, "but we have not." By the time the entire staff reconvened in New York, Phillips had reached a desperate resolution. If he could not persuade McClure to abandon his vainglorious scheme, he would resign. "It was a momentous decision for a man of 45 to make," Phillips wrote in an unpublished memoir. The impelling reasons were personal, almost spiritual. "I felt that I could not submit to being wrenched into courses and proposed undertakings that would arouse inner dissension with no prospect of peace. As soon as the decision was made, there was a great calm, a serene contentment." When McClure learned of Phillips' decision, he summoned Tarbell to his office and demanded to know whether anybody else is going. She informed him that she, too, would resign. Staying on without Phillips, she insisted, would be like living in a house with a corpse. At the prospect of her desertion, McClure broke down. "You too, Ida Tarbell," he accused. Tarbell recorded in her diary that night that as McClure railed against their departure and reiterated his abiding love for her, all she could think of was Napoleon at Fontainebleau. Her attempts to explain to McClure that for Phillips it was a question of his own soul, that it was no longer possible to live in such humiliation as he has had to endure, failed to penetrate his hysteria. Finally, she wrote, "McClure sprang up and flung his arms around me and kissed me, left weeping, and I sat down sobbing hysterically, but am more convinced than ever that we are right." In the immediate aftermath of their declared intention to resign, a compromise was nearly reached. Phillips and Tarbell agreed to remain if McClure would democratize the management of the magazine by creating a board of directors and putting a portion of his stock into a trusteeship administered by Tarbell, Phillips, Steffens, and Baker. When McClure acquiesced, the three of them went off to an awkward lunch together. McClure returned to the office looking cheerful for the first time in weeks. An agreement was drawn up. Then, just as swiftly as McClure had agreed, he changed his mind. The notion that the magazine had become an institution beyond the ability of one man to run, he now told Phillips, was utterly absurd. Though he traveled a great deal, such excursions had always proven invaluable to the magazine. "My facilities for getting to know public opinion and the opinion of able thinkers is vastly greater than it was 10 years ago," he insisted. "The management of this magazine is probably not 1/1000th as difficult as Abraham Lincoln's job, but Lincoln could never have managed his job had it not been for the extraordinary facilities that went with his position for sensing public opinion." The more he contemplated the matter, the more he realized it would be utterly impossible for him to accept a lesser role in the magazine. "When you read history," he proclaimed, "you find that kings who have come to the end of their tether, as a rule, would suffer death rather than give up part of their power." By grandiose analogy, he would rather sell his majority interests than relinquish control. Tarbell and Phillips immediately offered to purchase his McClure stock. Even as this new document was generated, however, McClure again rescinded the decision. "I cannot leave the magazine," he declared to Tarbell. "I would soon lose my mind." Discussion then shifted to the possibility that he would buy out the stock of Phillips and Tarbell, enabling them to start their own magazine. Throughout these negotiations and reversals, Brady recalled, the entire office was embroiled in the turmoil. Members of the staff were compelled to take sides, whether or not they wished to do so, but some did it secretly, afraid to express their opinion aloud. It was not unusual to see small groups of men with their heads together speaking in undertones, and then busy themselves when someone else came along. It soon became clear that the majority of the staff backed Phillips and Tarbell, including Steffens, Baker, Boyden, and John Sidall. Explaining his decision to resign in a letter to his father, Steffens observed that McClure had been away for months, playing and getting well. Then, upon his return, he had embarked upon a big fool scheme of founding a new magazine with a string of banks, insurance companies, etc., and a capitalization of $15 million. It was not only fool, it was not quite right. Indeed, it seemed a speculative scheme designed to extract money from investors that would never be repaid, much like the schemes McClure's magazine had been exposing over the years. Having built up McClure's, given it purpose and character, and increased its circulation so that it was a power as well as a dividend payer, we did not, Steffens maintained, propose to stand by and see it exploited and used, even by the owner. During this tumultuous period, Ray Baker had been absent from the office completing his railroad articles. Apprised of the situation by a stream of alarming letters, he confided to his wife on March 9th that McClure had become so utterly unbalanced and unreasonable that he is almost past working with. A week later, he grimly concluded that dynamite, nitroglycerin, and black powder had been laid and could not be diffused. When the time came, Baker decided to join his departing associates, who, he told his father, are not only my friends, but who have contributed largely to whatever success I have attained. The departure left Baker painfully adrift. I was left with no certainty, at the moment anyway, of continuing to do the work to which I was most deeply devoted. I was lost in a fog of contention and antagonism. Recalling the discord years later, Baker acknowledged that, in the afterlook, these ills seemed trivial enough. At the time, they were all but catastrophic. As rumors spread about the impending breakup at McClure's, many in the press mistakenly attributed the schism to a memorable address that President Roosevelt delivered that same spring. Exasperated by a sensationalist attack on the United States Senate in a magazine owned by his hated political rival, William Randolph Hearst, Roosevelt denounced investigative journalists as muckrakers, bent on relentless negativity and dispiriting exploitation of the nation's ills. In Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, he began, "You may recall the description of the man with the muckrake, the man who could look no way but downward." Bunyan's muckraker, he suggested, typifies the man who in this life consistently refuses to see aught that is lofty, and fixes his eyes with solemn intentness only on that which is vile and debasing. The coincidence of this speech and the first reports of dissension at the magazine led reporters to speculate that McClure had responded to the president's denunciation of muckraking with a decision to soften future exposés. According to such accounts, Tarbell, Steffens, and Baker, unwilling to accept the change in policy, had deserted to form their own magazine. McClure unequivocally rejected reports that Roosevelt's speech had in any way affected his views of what a magazine ought to be. McClure, as he insisted, would continue to report the activities of contemporary life, as it had always done. Nonetheless, the lingering implication that the editor had planned to muzzle his writers exacerbated the McClure's distress. The Treason of the Senate, the explosive series that aroused Roosevelt's ire, was conceived by William Randolph Hearst, who had long targeted the trust-dominated Senate in his newspapers. During Hearst's short career as a Democratic congressman from New York, and throughout his failed presidential run in 1904, the flamboyant publisher had agitated for a constitutional amendment stipulating popular election of senators. A democratic process, he argued, should replace the current system of election by state legislatures. The 1905 purchase of his first monthly magazine, The Cosmopolitan, provided an ideal forum to continue his campaign. He offered David Graham Phillips, the best-selling progressive novelist, a handsome price and substantial research help to undertake an investigation of the Senate's betrayal of the public interest. The first of 9 monthly installments appeared in March of 1906, just as Roosevelt was battling to secure Senate approval of his signature bill to regulate the railroads. "Treason is a strong word," the David Graham Phillips series began, "but not too strong, rather too weak to characterize a situation in which the Senate is the eager, resourceful, indefatigable agent of interests as hostile to the American people as any invading army could be, and vastly more dangerous. Interests that manipulate the prosperity produced by all so that it heaps up riches for the few." In the course of the series, Phillips would sketch individual biographies of 18 Republican and 3 Democratic senators. Each portrait revealed a triangulation between the senator's eagerness to assist corporations, the increase of his personal wealth, and the expansion of his influence in Washington. Though criticism of the Senate's hostility to progressive reform was not new, the scathing language and focused attack on the most powerful Republican leaders, including Lodge, Aldrich, Elkins, and Knox, attracted widespread attention. The circulation of the Cosmopolitan doubled overnight. Throughout the country, small daily and weekly newspapers reprinted individual articles. Little wonder, historian George Morey observed, that Theodore Roosevelt feared a general discrediting of his party, the national legislature, and, indeed, the administration, if the effects of such charges were not somehow dissipated. New York Senator Chauncey Depew, who had nominated Roosevelt for governor in 1898, was targeted in the first piece. "For those who like the sight of a corpse well beaten up," one newspaper editorialized, "this mean portrait deserved the championship belt." Under a picture of Depew, the caption announced, "Here is the archetypal face of the sleek, self-satisfied American opportunist in politics and plunder." Railroad barons Cornelius and William Vanderbilt were identified as the men who first enlisted Depew in personal and official service, and ever since then have owned mentally and morally. Throughout the article, charges of boodler and robber were leveled alongside the labels coward and sniveling sycophant. Although he never accused Depew of outright venality, Phillips argued that the New York senator, like many of his colleagues, was thoroughly beholden to the campaign contributions of the special interests. The tone of the piece appalled Roosevelt. He told his journalist friend Alfred Henry Lewis that while he had the heartiest sympathy and commendation for responsible attacks on corruption, hysteria and sensationalism would fail to produce any permanent good, and the country would conclude that the liar is in the long run as noxious as the thief. The series produced outrage in the conservative press. The Critic accused Phillips of sowing the seeds of anarchy. The New York Sun asserted that debasing an institution created by the founding fathers was tantamount to playing with matches in dangerous proximity to a powder magazine. Speaking in defense of the Senate, Henry Cabot Lodge declared, "Slander and misrepresentation directed against individuals are not of much importance, but wise institutions and free systems of government, painfully wrought, tried in the fires of sacrifice and suffering, should endure." Concerned that the epidemic of Congress baiting would jeopardize his regulatory program, Roosevelt devised a clever counterstroke. On March 17, 1906, at the annual dinner of the Gridiron Club, an informal assembly of reporters, editors, cabinet officials, and leaders in business and academia, Roosevelt delivered his own piece of propaganda. After a series of humorous skits, Roosevelt spoke without notes for 45 minutes, railing against muckrakers who saturated magazines and newspapers with sensational articles, dredging all that is bleak and corrupt while ignoring at the same time the good in the world. He had initially planned to indict David Graham Phillips, but Elihu Root persuaded him that a personal attack would only fuel the writer's celebrity. By avoiding a direct condemnation of the Treason series, however, Roosevelt inadvertently left the audience speculating about his intended targets. In truth, the president's attack on the muckrakers reflected more than momentary anger at Hearst and David Graham Phillips. His exasperation with the proliferation of increasingly sensational and shoddily investigated exposure journalism had been slowly building. While the masters at McClure's typically invested months and even years of careful research in their studies, a host of less meticulous and principled imitators had followed in their wake. In the competition for hot stuff, politicians and businessmen were being tried and found guilty in magazine counting rooms before the investigation is begun. The carefully documented quest for truth had been supplanted by slapdash, often slanderous accusations. Even when the articles rested on solid documentary evidence, Roosevelt feared that an incessant fixation on corruption had begun to produce a very unhealthy condition of excitement and irritation in the public mind, leading to an enormous increase in socialistic propaganda. As usual, Peter Dunne's Mr. Dooley trenchantly captured public agitation. There was once a time, the Irish bartender opined, when reading popular magazines calmed the mind. Readers came away feeling that life was a glad, sweet song. Indeed, one could drape his watch on the knob of an unlocked door, confident that it would be there in the morning. Now, however, a reader turning the pages of any magazine would discover that everything has gone wrong. Corruption and double-dealing today were so rampant that the world is little better, Dooley concluded, than a convict's camp. Roosevelt immensely enjoyed Mr. Dooley's outlook. "I get sick of people who are always insisting upon nothing but the dark side of life," he told Dunne. "There are a lot of things that need correction in this country, but there is not the slightest use of feeling over-pessimistic about it." National fatigue with the ubiquitous literature of exposure had already set in when Roosevelt spoke to the Gridiron Club. The public cannot stand at attention with its eyes fixed on one spot indefinitely, literary critic Edwin E. Slosson shrewdly observed. It is bound to get restive and seek diversion in other interests. A Wisconsin municipal court judge expressed the resentment of many. "It is getting so nowadays that the man or corporation that accumulates property to any extent is made the subject of these attacks." Nor, a fellow Wisconsin man observed, should a man be considered a criminal simply because he holds public office. The morning after the gridiron speech, Lincoln Steffens called on the president. "Well," Steffens reproached, "you have put an end to all these journalistic investigations that have made you." Roosevelt insisted that he had not intended a general indictment of legitimate reporters like Steffens. He was simply defending poor old Chauncey Depew against a terribly unfair portrait in the Hearst press. Steffens remained unconvinced, correctly sensing the president's growing impatience with the never-ending exposés, even as he relied on them to mobilize public opinion. In fact, on several occasions the previous year, Roosevelt had directly criticized Steffens for his tendency to repeat as true unfounded gossip of a malicious or semi-malicious character. It was an absurdity, he had scolded Steffens, to claim that Senator Aldrich was the boss of the United States. Such a preposterous claim, he believed, carried a sinister significance, for we suffer quite as much from exaggerated, hysterical, and untruthful statements in the press as from any wrongdoing by businessmen or politicians. Roosevelt had also decried Steffens' characterization of Postmaster General Henry C. Payne as the ringleader of a corrupt effort to fix legislators and thereby destroy Governor La Follette's legislative program. "Poor Payne is sick either unto death or nigh unto death," Roosevelt had complained to Lodge 2 days before Payne died. This attack on him in McClure's magazine by Steffens was, I think, the immediate cause of breaking him down, and I am convinced that it is an infamously false attack. Nevertheless, Steffens had continued to enjoy unusual access to the White House. When he arrived in Washington to investigate whether the corruption uncovered in city and state governments extended to the federal level, Roosevelt offered to help. The president provided the celebrated journalist with a card inscribed, "To any officer or employee of the government, please tell Mr. Lincoln Steffens anything whatever about the running of the government that you know, not incompatible with the public interest, and provided only that you tell him the truth, no matter what it may be. I will see that you are not hurt. T. Roosevelt. The resultant syndicated series, however, nettled Roosevelt. To Steffens, the signal question America faced could not be answered with the passage of railroad regulation or food and drug laws, but only with fundamental change to the corrupt system that invested special interests with undue power at the expense of the people. I'd rather make our government represent us than dig the canal. The president would rather dig the canal and regulate railway rates. So he makes his deal with the speaker. And I condemn it. Roosevelt was especially angered by reformers' accusations that he was too compromising in his efforts to remedy the abuses of capitalism. In stating your disapproval of my efforts to get results, he wrote Steffens, which, of course, must be gotten by trying to come to a working agreement with the Senate and House, and therefore by making mutual concessions, you have often said or implied that I ought to refuse to make any concessions, but stand uncompromisingly for my beliefs and let the people decide. As a matter of fact, I have come a great deal nearer getting what I wanted than, for instance, Governor La Follette. Roosevelt grumbled that Steffens and his friends failed to understand the requisites of practical leadership, a sense of when to move forward, when to hold back, when to mobilize the public, when to negotiate behind closed doors. Leadership that led to genuine progress depended upon an acute sense of timing, a feel for both the public and the congressional pulse. Yet in recent months, it had seemed that crusading writers were intent on usurping his authority, creating the intolerable impression that rather than summoning, Roosevelt was being dragged. All these frustrations had informed Roosevelt's decision to castigate the new journalism at the Gridiron Club dinner. Remarks at the informal club meeting were traditionally off the record, but word of the president's dramatic condemnation spread like wildfire, along with speculation he was referencing progressive writers such as Lincoln Steffens, Ray Baker, David Phillips, and Upton Sinclair. When Roosevelt announced his intention to reiterate his gridiron message in a public address, Baker was dumbfounded, concerned that such an attack might greatly injure the work we are trying honestly to do. He finally concluded to write a frank letter to the president. "I have been much disturbed at the report of your proposed address," Baker began. "Even admitting that some of the so-called exposures have been extreme," he inquired, "have they not, as a whole, been honest and useful? And would not a speech, backed by all your great authority, attacking the magazines, tend to give aid and comfort to these very rascals, whose activities were being exposed by hard-working journalists? Moreover," he warned, "the first to stop the work of letting in the light and air will be those who have been trying honestly to tell the whole truth, good and bad, and leave the field to the outright ranters and inciters." Roosevelt was undeterred. "One reason I want to make that address," he replied the next day, "is because people so persistently misunderstand what I said." The president confided in Baker that Hearst's papers and magazines were his intended target, and promised his speech would clarify that he abhorred the whitewash brush quite as much as of mudslinging. Roosevelt delivered his formal muckrake man address on April 14, 1906. That he seriously considered Baker's concerns is evident in his carefully measured speech. He cautioned that his words must not be distorted, insisting at the risk of repetition that the fight against corruption and exploitation must continue. Every word of reproach against the crusading journalists was counterbalanced with a word of commendation. He termed their investigations indispensable, yet explained that when muckrakers penned sensational, lurid, and untruthful articles, they became potent forces for evil. In the end, however, Roosevelt's vivid portrait of the muckraker eclipsed his positive remarks about investigative journalism. His speech was widely received as an indiscriminate attack on all reform journalists. Commentators reflected that the president could not publicly speak upon a question which is shaking the country from center to circumference without exercising a powerful influence upon one side or the other. And despite his almost nervous dread of misinterpretation, Roosevelt had put into the hands of every trust magnate, every insurance thief, every political corruptionist, a handy weapon which will be used unconscionably for their defense. All such interests, one journal predicted, would now plead not guilty, point to the muckrake, and seek shelter behind the portly figure of the president. Baker read the speech as a profound betrayal. He noted, sadly, that while Roosevelt had indeed employed his familiar balance of approval and disapproval, he had failed to distinguish between the sensationalist yellow press and the responsible journalists. He did not think it worthwhile to acknowledge the service of those men who had been striving to tell the truth, honestly and completely, whose work he had repeatedly approved, and for whose help he had again and again expressed his appreciation, Baker later wrote. Instead, the indelible image of the muckraker classed all of us together. Baker's alarm proved well-founded. McClure's magazine, the most illustrious journal, was singled out for a devastating satire in Life magazine. Each of the writers of McClure's magazine, Ida Tarbarrel, Ray Standard Faker, Sinkum Beffins, was viciously mocked in turn. "I'm giving my whole life to breaking the butterfly of a John Rockefeller upon the wheel of my ponderous articles," Tarbarrel was quoted as saying. "He's got too much money. If that isn't a shame, I'd like to know what a shame is." In another scathing send-up, Stephens Beffins humbly submitted to a supposed interview, "I'm not really great. I'm only eminent, unparalleled, superlatively remarkable." Pondering such achievement, the interviewer highlighted Stephens' process. With only his suitcase and his gold rake studded with diamonds, he can take the morning train for an unknown city, rake off in a few hours the thick slime of municipally great, "I'm only eminent, unparalleled, superlatively remarkable." Pondering such achievement, the interviewer highlighted Stephens' process. With only his suitcase and his gold rake studded with diamonds, he can take the morning train for an unknown city, rake off in a few hours the thick slime of municipal corruption, and have a shame-shrieking article ready for McClure's by night. These satirical jabs cut Baker deeply, his biographer claims. The bubble of devoted public service that had developed around his work had been irreparably punctured. Deeply demoralized to find his name among those cast into outer darkness, Baker would never forgive Roosevelt. "I met the president many times afterward, and there were numerous exchanges of letters," Baker recalled. "But while I could wonder at his remarkable versatility of mind and admire his many robust human qualities, I could never again give him my full confidence nor follow his leadership." In the wake of the president's speech, morale among conservatives and corporate interests rallied. The New York Sun proclaimed that the muckraker's era of exposure had come to an end. It was a great day while it lasted, but it became too hot. The muckrakers worked merrily for a time in their own bright sunshine, and an unthinking populace applauded their performance. Now there are few to do them reverence. It was said only partly in jest that rebaters and bribers were beginning to walk abroad with the old smile, sensing that the tidal wave of magazine reform was finally abating. Progressives mounted an impassioned defense of the magazine crusaders. One supporter argued that these journalists numbered among the loftiest and purest of living patriots, who have taken their professional and political lives in their hands that they might serve as soldiers of the common good. Their long, laborious work had initiated the inspiring movement for honest government. No fair-minded citizen could deny the astonishingly great influence of Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, or Ray Baker. "The day will come," one sympathetic commentator correctly predicted, "when the muckrake will be borne through the streets as a triumphant emblem of reform, when the epithet muckraker would become a badge of honor." On May 11, 1906, 4 weeks after the president's speech, the New York Times confirmed that Phillips, Tarbell, Steffens, Baker, and Boyden were leaving McClure's. Furthermore, it was understood that the five were quietly planning to start a magazine venture of their own. After weeks of turmoil, McClure had finally agreed to buy out Phillips and Tarbell, whose combined stock was worth $187,000. He also promised each of them 6 months' salary at full pay. "I am certain that it is not in my power at the present time adequately to reward them for their services, which no money could pay for," McClure told a business associate. "They leave me retaining my deepest love and affection and esteem and confidence. I think I may say that it is the greatest tragedy thus far of my life to lose them." With Baker and Steffens, he was equally generous, continuing their salaries while they completed work on already contracted projects. "I wish you all good fortune," he told Baker. "I've always enjoyed working with you, and your work has been very successful in the magazine, and I am very sorry to lose you." Moved by his publisher's remarkable magnanimity, Steffens observed, "There was nothing mean about S.S. McClure." In the aftermath of the schism, McClure lost not only his star writers, but his partner, managing editor, and three top business executives as well. While some in the publishing world wondered if he could survive the loss of the inimitable team that had given the magazine its chief features of life and popularity, Sam McClure proved surprisingly resilient in the face of catastrophe. Necessity compelled him to abandon his colossal scheme and focus all his energies on rebuilding the magazine. "I have really to look after almost every department," he told Hattie, "and am getting up material for the fall prospectus. I am standing it splendidly. I rarely get tired." Without Phillips to maintain daily operations, he could no longer escape responsibility and found himself working harder than ever before. In the office by 8 a.m., McClure remained at his desk long past midnight, sustaining himself on 3 or 4 quarts of milk a day. After midnight, he retired to an apartment located on a floor above the magazine's offices to read masses of manuscripts, including portions of an autobiography by Mark Twain, which his syndicate had agreed to publish. In a matter of weeks, McClure managed to assemble an almost completely new roster of talent. Of the original team, only poetry editor Widder Binner, manuscript reader Viola Roseborough, and the three Brady brothers, Curtis, Oscar, and Ed, remained. To replace Ida Tarbell, he relied upon Willa Cather, a little-known fiction writer who would become a world-class novelist. He hired Will Irwin, a distinguished reporter from the New York Sun, as managing editor. Two first-rate investigative reporters, George Kibbe Turner and Burton Hendrick, joined the staff full-time, along with Ellery Sedgwick, the future editor of the Atlantic Monthly. The very name McClure's magazine had an irresistible attraction for any young man, Sedgwick explained. Much like Tarbell, Baker, and Steffens had described their chief in happier years, Sedgwick was mesmerized by McClure's burning force, explaining how everyone about him caught fire, and he would inflame the intelligence of his staff into molten excitement. Though his eager new writers lacked the renown of the original team, McClure reasoned that before long he would be able to repeat the process that had made Tarbell, Steffens, and Baker household names. The newly constituted group indeed produced a number of significant investigations in the months that followed, but the tenor of the magazine, reflecting the temper of the nation, had changed. Even before Roosevelt delivered his muckrake speech, McClure had sensed that public interest in the parade of public and private misbehavior was waning. To go on now with the heavy exposure articles, he told his stockholders, would not convert those who disagree with us, and those who agree with us don't need conversion. Furthermore, the new staff members brought differing sensibilities and strategies to McClure's. While Ellery Sedgwick had applauded the early efforts of the crusading journalists, he believed the time had come to halt and to think soberly. Too many editors, he charged, had lost all sense of responsibility in the race for circulation. Ida Tarbell's replacement, Willa Cather, also had a profound influence on the magazine's direction. While she edited a superb series on Christian Science founder Mary Baker Eddy, Cather's genius lay in literature, in historical narratives, rather than accounts of present-day political struggles and economic analyses. Consequently, while the quality of fiction and poetry in McClure's remained high, the impact of the magazine's investigative pieces diminished. McClure's was not alone. A similar shift took place in popular publications across the country. A literature of distraction gradually replacing the literature of inquiry. If an exhilarating sense of excitement and adventure permeated the revivified magazine in the early months, it was not long before McClure's mercurial temperament produced unbearable tensions within the newly organized staff. As managing editor, Will Irwin found it impossible to deal with the endless intrigues McClure manufactured. As a curb on genius, he acknowledged, I was not a success. Sedgwick reported that the staff worked under some natural law of desperation. The chief was forever interrupting, cutting every sequence into a dozen parts. The dynamic had become frustrating. A week in the McClure office was the precise reversal of the six busy days described in the first chapter of Genesis. It seemed to end in a world without form and void. From order came forth chaos. In 15 months, both Sedgwick and Irwin were fired. McClure soldiered on. For years, the fiction and poetry that he scouted and commissioned would continue to set the literary standard for American magazines. He published early stories of Damon Runyon and Joseph Conrad, introduced A.E. Housman's Shropshire Lad to the American public, and provided a forum for the new work of William Butler Yeats and Moira O'Neill. The company eventually foundered, however, hampered by the costs of buying out the departing writers and constructing a new printing plant in Long Island. Forced to economize, McClure could no longer continue his penchant for liberal spending to attract the most gifted writers. Nor could he afford to keep his book publishing arm, which he sold to Doubleday Page and Company. The magazine never recovered the strength or influence it had exerted during its heyday. Public disenchantment with sensationalist journalism and Theodore Roosevelt's dramatic caricature of the muckrakers may have conspired to diminish the stature and power of McClure's. The real corrosion of the magazine's intensive energy happened from within, however, precipitated by the same force that had made the enterprise great, the outsized personality and manic power of S.S. McClure himself. The shifting public mood also presented difficulties for Phillips and the rest of the departing team. They had initially planned to launch their own venture, but when American Magazine, a monthly of good reputation, was offered for sale, they pooled their resources to meet the $400,000 price tag. At the time, the American was just about holding its own financially. By recreating the publication as a writer's magazine, built upon their own good names, they hoped to raise the circulation and make it profitable within a comparatively short time. All of us had plunged into the enterprise with astonishingly little regard for the future, Baker recalled. No one of us had much money. We put into the common fund all we had and more. In addition, the friends decided to heavily cut their own paychecks until they turned a profit. If the magazine failed, Baker acknowledged, he stood to lose everything. Still, he told his father, there was nothing so dizzily stimulating as building a new enterprise, resting in complete confidence upon one's friends, devoted to what one considers high purposes, each sacrificing to the limit for the common cause. For Steffens, too, trepidation mingled with excitement. I feel as if I were at the crisis of my life, he wrote. We are buying an old magazine, which we propose to make the greatest thing of the kind that was ever made in this world. Sincere, but good-natured. Honest, but humorous. Aggressive, but not unkind. A straight, hard fighter, but cheerful. Though Ida Tarbell seemed to Baker the most dauntless of the adventurers, she fully recognized what was at stake. Each of them had seen something in which they deeply believed go to pieces, she recalled. All of them had been too cruelly bruised to take anything lightly. William Allen White followed his friends to the American magazine. though not party to the bitter final months in the McClure's office, White had nevertheless determined long before that, despite Sam McClure's spark of genius, the magazine's stability and success had always relied upon the ballast of John Phillips. White chose to help finance the American, but maintained that he bore absolutely no ill will toward McClure or his magazine, where he had received nothing but the kindest treatment. Indeed, even as he cast his lot with the new venture, he reached out to McClure. "You may draw on me whenever you will, for whatever you will," he assured the editor. Everyone recognized that creating cohesion, building a trusting yet playful atmosphere, would foster the success of the American. When Phillips and Tarbell persuaded Finley Peter Dunne, Mr. Dooley's creator, to join the group, Baker was thrilled. "Everything amuses him. We were youthful and dead in earnest, and he was wise." Dunne proved himself a great companion, who loved so much to talk that he could entertain his office mates for hours. "He had a wide knowledge of men and their ways," Tarbell recalled. "Whenever conflict arose within the team, Mr. Dooley could be relied upon to lighten the heavy mood." As managing editor, Albert Boyden made it his business to foster camaraderie among his writers and contributors at the new magazine. At his fourth-floor walk-up in Stuyvesant Square, he hosted regular dinners for a revolving group of novelists, artists, politicians, and scientists. "What talk went on in that high-up living room," Tarbell recalled. "What wonderful tales we heard." The press assumed that with all the muckrakers muckraking under one tent, the American magazine would provide a helpful experiment to determine whether the public appetite for exposure journalism had truly atrophied. Their muckraking has been of the convincing rather than the frenzied variety, and they have reputations for literary honesty to be maintained, the Evening World Herald observed. "This is undoubtedly the most notable combination that has ever launched any publication." The Boston Journal of Education expressed certitude that the pioneers of authentic investigative journalism would produce an outstanding magazine. While the new publishing team proudly proclaimed that they would not be deterred by adjectives or phrases, their first public announcement nevertheless reflected anxiety about the shift in popular sentiment. "We should not only make this new American magazine interesting and important in a public way, but we shall make it the most stirring and delightful monthly book of fiction, humor, sentiment, and joyous reading that is anywhere published. It will reflect a happy, struggling, fighting world, in which, as we believe, good people are coming out on top. There is no field of human activity in which we are not interested. Our magazine will be wholesome, hopeful, stimulating, uplifting, and above all, it will have a human interest on every page." The statement provoked a wave of positive commentary in the press, accompanied by pointed advice. "Reformers need relaxation," the Outlook observed, "and it has sometimes seemed of late as if, in his endeavor to secure greatly needed righteousness, the ardent and patriotic American might lose his ability to be at ease in a world in which there are so many sources of pleasure as well as of pain." William Allen White, whose cheerful temperament had never really suited him for muckraking, offered similar counsel. "It seems to me the great danger," he told Phillips, "is that of being too purposeful. People will expect the pale, drawn face, the set lips, and a general line of emotional insanity. You should fool them." In the end, the new enterprise suffered not from a surfeit of purpose, but from a lack of direction. Pressure to fill pages in the early months led to a publication without the focused passion and clear vision of the old McClures. "We are editing in a very funny way," Boyden acknowledged. "We rush in every good thing every month and trust to the Lord to send more." Phillips implored each writer to look into his literary cupboard for half-finished work and send it pell-mell to New York. Consequently, those early issues comprised a miscellany. Tarbell submitted articles on Abraham Lincoln and John D. Rockefeller as she began a long series on the tariff. White contrasted Emporia and New York in one article, and the altruistic and egotistic spirit of man in the other. Steffens profiled William Randolph Hearst and produced admiring portraits of several prominent progressives or upbuilders, including the timber fraud prosecutor Francis Heaney and idealistic millionaire Rudolph Spreckels. And Baker, while investigating the problem of race in America, contributed a long series of articles on the pastoral joys to be found outside the nation's growing cities. The Country Life series proved a much-needed tonic for Ray Baker's life and career. Utterly beaten down with weariness following the disintegration of McClure's, he had returned to the safe haven of his country home in East Lansing, still a small village surrounded by farmhouses and stretches of wilderness. Just as the rugged Arizona landscape had once provided solace during an earlier period of depression, so Michigan's natural beauties now absorbed his attention. For hours each day, he split cordwood, mulched fruit trees, and planted shrubs. Such hard physical work began to restore his body and mind. When he received Philip's request to rummage his literary cupboard, Baker turned to the private journals he had been keeping for nearly a decade. In these pages, he had recorded not only his thoughts on politics and economics, but daily observations of rural life. Reading over these entries, he conceived the idea of a fictional alter ego, an educated, successful man who had abandoned his frenetic city life for the rigors and simple pleasures of life on a farm. When Baker sat down to organize his thoughts, memories of his childhood in the frontier town of St. Croix and winters working as a schoolteacher in small Michigan farming communities mingled with his recent experiences in East Lansing. Writing more easily than ever before, Baker completed 6 potential installments for the magazine in 3 weeks. Anxious that the portrait of country life would confound readers accustomed to his hard-hitting investigative journalism, he chose to solicit an opinion of new work using the pen name David Grayson. Swearing Phillips and the staff to secrecy, he mailed out the manuscript with a note, "Take care of my child." Though he later acknowledged how ridiculous his request must have appeared, this more intimate mode of writing was something utterly different than his previous successful work. Finally, after restless days spent rambling through the countryside, the editorial judgment from Phillips arrived by telegraph. Manuscript a delight. Bully boy, send more chapters. The David Grayson stories instantly resonated with the reading public. Fan letters arrived by the thousands. "You have sublimated the real but commonplace experiences of life that we all enjoy," one admirer wrote, "but never take the time or have the talent to write about." David Grayson clubs sprang up in all sections of the country. Women dreamed of marrying a gentleman like David Grayson, a philosopher-farmer with a well-stocked library who had found happiness and peace in growing things, farm auctions, country fairs, schoolhouse meetings, and neighborly conversations. "David Grayson is a great man," Lincoln Steffens told Baker. "I never had realized there was in you such a sense of beauty, so much fine philosophic wisdom, and most wonderful of all, serenity." Under such titles as Adventures in Contentment and Adventures in Friendship, the collected Grayson stories continued for decades, filling 6 books that sold over 2 million copies. Not until years later, when he discovered that imposters were presenting lectures and reading across the country under the name of David Grayson, did Baker finally claim Grayson's work as his own. While Phillips delighted in the acclaim given the Grayson stories, he had advised Baker, even before the series began, that people will be expecting something from you over your own name, something that is timely and notable and distinguished. The industrious Baker had no sooner completed his first Grayson installments than he embarked for San Francisco in early August of 1906. There, he documented the aftermath of the devastating earthquake and fire of the previous spring, before embarking on what critics considered his best magazine journalism, a pioneer study of the Negro in American life. His interest had been awakened by 2 previous articles on lynching he had produced for McClure's. Baker traveled extensively throughout the South and the North, talking with people, gathering statistics, reading local papers, and assembling data. Everywhere, he worked to get at the facts, to create a dispassionate portrait of African-American life, of racial prejudice and Jim Crow, of Southern moderates and Northern philanthropists. 3 decades later, in preparing An American Dilemma, Gunnar Myrdal relied on Baker's 12-part series as a major source. Still, this new work could not match the concrete impact of his earlier series on labor and the railroads. The Riddle of the Negro provided only the nebulous hope that a clear statement of the case would nudge Americans toward substituting understanding and sympathy for blind repulsion and hatred. One Pennsylvania newspaper observed, matter-of-factly, that the American was reporting the Negro problem with no effort to solve it. The issue of race in America, the Bedford Gazette agreed, was simply too complex to solve. In the first decade of the 20th century, a fair-minded discussion of the racial problem represented a significant step forward. The issues containing Baker's series sold throughout the country. "Your work has been a wonderful thing for us," Tarbell assured Baker, "and I am proud of you." Phillips appreciatively told Baker that people everywhere were talking about his articles on race, with the consensus that they were the best things running now in any magazine. If Baker contributed disproportionately to the first issues of the new magazine, Lincoln Steffens seriously disappointed his colleagues. Initially enamored of the idea of a writer's magazine, Steffens soon chafed at the consensus editing, allocation of space, demand for proof against libel, and hurried deadlines. "It does not matter," Phillips told Steffens, "how hard you work and write, if we don't get the material into the magazine when it needs it." The new magazine simply did not have the working capital McClure's had enjoyed to cover false starts or years of travel and research. Frayed by the production schedule, Boyden had small patience with Steffens' constant complaints that his articles were given less space in The American than they had been granted in McClure's. "You are crazy, Steff," Boyden testily replied, enclosing a comparison to show the griping was unfounded. Meanwhile, Boyden reminded Steffens he had failed to answer a request for pictures to accompany one of his articles. "We don't need any sleeping partners in this concern," Peter Dunn grumbled. Steffens shot a resentful letter to Phillips, enumerating his grievances. "It is very difficult for me to write calmly after receiving a letter such as yours," Phillips responded. "It seems to me not only unsympathetic, but unmanly. It repudiates all the terms of our association in its tone and its temper. It seems to me that you cannot stand on the threshold and speak spitefully through the door, that you should either come in or go out. I could very easily, by comparison, show you that you have had more out of this magazine than anybody else in proportion to what you have put in." Indeed, he pointed out, the magazine was covering not only Steffens' traveling expenses, but those of his wife and her elderly mother. "Most disappointing of all," Phillips rebuked his longtime friend and colleague, "you haven't confidence in us, and that is everything." Steffens remained oblivious to the vexation of the other staff members. He had money, celebrity, lecture invitations, and a new seaside estate near Coscob, Connecticut. "My husband has become famous," Josephine Steffens reflected sadly, "but at a high price." Steffens had issued a sanctimonious ultimatum to his partners. "Either I am to write as I please without being edited, or I quit." 6 months later, Steffens resigned from the magazine. At the time of his departure, Steffens argued that he must sell his stock in order to meet expenses while he sought a new position. His partners agreed to buy him out, further diminishing the working capital of the new enterprise. Through all the hurly-burly at The American, Ida Tarbell remained the same stabilizing force she had always been at McClure's. Only later did she acknowledge how disorienting the transition had been. "I know now I should not have taken it as well as I did, and inwardly that was nothing to boast of, if it had not been cushioned by an engrossing personal interest," she recalled. While her New York apartment had served as her writing headquarters for years, Ida had yearned for a country home. During the turbulent spring of 1906, she finally purchased an old farmhouse situated on 40 acres of land in Redding Ridge, Connecticut. She had initially planned to use the abandoned property as a retreat, doing only the most necessary maintenance. Soon, however, she was tempted to start borrowing and mortgaging to fix the roof and wallpaper the rooms, taking on extra freelance work to pay for furniture, rugs, and antiques. Before long, Tarbell turned her energies to the land. She pruned apple trees, planted crops, created a new orchard, and bought chickens, a cow, a pig, and two horses. Ever practical, she reallocated money set aside for an evening gown to purchase some much-needed fertilizer for the garden. Encouraged by the warmth and camaraderie of her rural neighbors, she learned what Baker had already discovered, that the most genuine of human dramas could be found in the trials and triumphs of the surrounding countryside. "All this was good for me," Ida reflected of her rural homemaking. "But while it was good for me, it was not so good for my work on the magazine." Preoccupied with the engaging task of furnishing her new home, she found her research on the tariff increasingly tedious. By pursuing the subject in her first big series for The American, she had hoped to expose the special interests that lay behind the complicated schedules for wool, iron ore, coal, sugar, or flax. She loathed protectionism and intended to get into the fight for revision. Nevertheless, after months in Washington studying every congressional record since the Civil War, Tarbell could not render the subject engaging or alive. Though she talked with senators and congressmen who had taken part in earlier tariff struggles, the debates that appeared so important to her were a dead issue to them. Tarbell's six-part series, The Tariff in Our Times, ran from December of 1906 through June of 1907. With three additional installments published 2 years later. Though critics lauded the comprehensive and careful accumulation of chronological information, most found the cumulative effect uninspiring. Tarbell dealt exhaustively, and at times exhaustingly, with events, one reviewer noted, but the whole remained invertebrate. She was the first to admit that her early installments lacked vitality, and that she relied too heavily on second-hand material. "The series had no cohesive force," William Allen White told her candidly. "It is not written around the progressive narrative. It continues, but doesn't get anywhere. There is no beginning, climax, and end. There's no crescendo." It seemed to White that the project required exactly what McClure had prescribed as Tarbell researched the Standard Oil Company, a central figure that would hold the reader. While Tarbell's series would eventually build momentum during the fiery debates over the Payne-Aldrich tariff in 1909, her initial contribution did little to buoy the struggling fortunes of the American magazine. On July 1, 1907, Tarbell wrote a long letter to Bert Boyden offering her assessment of the magazine's first year. Something was missing, she conceded. A certain hustle, ingenuity. A generalizing effort such as we used to get out of SS. It's a talent, a genius, and we haven't it in the staff. Uncannily, Ida Tarbell received a letter that same day from her old friend and former chief. "I dreamed of you," McClure told her. "I thought I was telling you how I found out that by speaking slowly and calmly and acting calmly, I found I had much greater influence on people. I am actually doing this. And I thought that I was standing by your chair, and you drew me down and kissed me to show your approval." "When you disapproved of me, it nearly broke my heart," McClure confided, offering a final touching confession. "I never ceased to love you, as I have for many, many years. I wish you had not turned away."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.